everyone. I'm Jacopo Dettoni, and this is the FDI podcast. Today, I'm joined once again remotely by Robert Volterra. Frankly, Mr. Volterra needs little introduction. He's a partner with the eponymous law firm Volterra Fietta, a visiting professor of international law at the University College London, UCL, and a visiting senior lecturer at King's College, also here in London. More broadly, we can say that Mr. Volterra is really a thought leader in the fields of international law, foreign investment, and arbitration, which is why it is a great pleasure for us to have him here at the FDI podcast to discuss COVID-19 and the arbitration risks that the pandemic brings along. So welcome to the show, Mr. Volterra.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me. I look forward to our conversation.
In the past few months, we have witnessed and personal experience, obviously, government interventions that have created unprecedented disruption for households, societies, and economies. Can they also give rise to arbitration claims and legal disputes?
Yes, they can. These activities of governments have exposed countries to disputes at the state-to-state level and disputes from foreign investors against governments and the actions they've taken, supposedly in response to the pandemic, although sometimes it's highly questionable.
Why do you say it's hardly questionable? So is there any particular way these countries, as you say, have exposed themselves?
The World Health Organization, very early on in January 2020, was advising governments not to impose travel bans. Yet many countries did, and this will have had a negative effect on any number of industries, including airline industries. That's just one example. There's also been examples around the world of governments engaging in various kinds of regulations of the economy that is easily defensible, logical, rational, consistent with accepted pandemic prevention and suppression and that sort of thing. And there's also been examples, and we've all seen them in the press, of actions taken by governments that don't seem to have any scientific or medical basis.
But we have also learned in the past few months that science is also a sort of a relative concept. Also, if you look at the same virologists, different people would tell you different things about this pandemic. And I guess that, so from the perspective of a policymaker, I would argue this is what my science in that particular moment was suggesting me to do.
Oh, absolutely. And don't get me wrong. I act in equal measure for governments and investors in the space of investor-state arbitration. And we've been advising both investors and governments in this context over the last half year. Absolutely. The science can be confusing. The medical advice can be, somewhat shifting. And this appears to be perfectly natural. I'm not a doctor or a scientist, but this seems to be natural as the world of science and medicine get to know what is happening with a particular virus and how it operates. And
right.
Governments certainly are perfectly entitled to regulate, respond, change how they respond as the science develops and so on. Absolutely. But there's also things that could not be justified. So it's one thing, it would be one thing for a government to say, well, in March of 2020, this is what the scientific advice was, and therefore we took these steps because that was connected with the scientific advice. One can also imagine a situation where, despite the government saying, well, this was our scientific advice, and so we needed to do something, but what they did was actually unconnected with the scientific advice. For example, if the scientific advice says something like, people should not go into mines during the pandemic because they will spread disease, and a government passed regulations saying all foreign mines must close, but domestically owned mines can stay open.
Right.
Well, one might say, well, okay, there is some vague connection with science in what you did, but you clearly discriminated against the foreigner, for example.
So on what ground investors might be willing to sue host states when it comes to specifically to investor-state disputes? Are we always talking on the ground of provisions included in bilateral investment treaties?
Generally speaking, yes. Generally speaking, because it is usually only investment treaties or investment chapters of broader trade and economic treaties that provide individuals and companies, as opposed to their home state, the ability to commence binding arbitration against a government where they made an investment. Generally, one would need to look at the specific terms of any given treaty. And there are some treaties that specifically allow for a government to take emergency measures, even if they're harmful to foreign investors, as long as they're not discriminatory. It's not like every single act of a government that hurts the economy is going to make the country liable to be sued. The opposite side of the coin is exactly the same. Not just because there has been a pandemic, not every government activity has therefore been condoned.
Why wouldn't governments just claim something like force majeure to justify their interventions?
The concept of force majeure at international law is not necessarily the same as it is in domestic law, because it's meant to regulate private relationships and private legal obligations. Mm-hmm. And it's not self-evident that it is always going to apply when there is state activity involved at the international plane. Right? So when a state is acting as a state on the international plane, and that's where you get a treaty obligation, for example, that's at the international level. It's different than when a state is, say, a signatory to a concession contract or a commercial obligation, in which force majeure provisions may apply. A state has responsibility for complying with international law, and there are certain bases on which a state is excused from certain responsibility that would otherwise apply in certain circumstances. There are certain sort of emergency powers and emergency measures that are occasionally recognized to states as being reasons why they might be able to do something on a temporary basis, a sort of an emergency measures response. Indeed, it's interesting that the international health regulations that were promulgated in 2005 under the World Health Organization recognizes that states have the right to regulate autonomously in pursuit of their own health policies, that it's the states that have the sovereign right to legislate or implement legislation in relation to health policies. And there's some limitations on that, but that's sort of another question.
You mentioned also at the beginning that the World Health Organization at the very beginning advised countries not to close their border or not to instate limitations to traveling and to trade, but many countries did anyways. But at the same time, as far as I understand it, these are non-binding suggestions.
Absolutely correct. The problem arising in relation to the World Health Organization and some criticisms, the World Health Organization and the Director General can only really issue recommendations, indicate best practices, facilitate states cooperating, and so on. They are non-binding. One reads in the press about declarations from various politicians around the world that such and such country should be blamed for this and such country should be blamed for that. But ultimately, the problem with the international health regulations and the World Health Organization per se is operating rules of the organization don't create a binding compulsory mechanism. The World Health Organization is intended to be a center of expertise, excellence, facilitate cooperation, et cetera, et cetera. It's not meant to be a police force.
From this perspective, in a way, its recommendation cannot be used by investors for potential arbitration claims against the host states.
The answer is a little bit more equivocal. It's not quite so clear cut. because the recommendations of the World Health Organization should show best practice, best scientific knowledge, best medical information, and so on. And so the recommendations of the World Health Organization would be indicative of good practice on the part of a state in terms of how it would be responding to the COVID virus. There will be an extraordinary amount of latitude given to states to regulate in such an emergency. States may be called upon to justify rationally the actions they have taken. And I gave an example, as you recall earlier, that you know, discriminatory treatment that favors, you know, home investors, home businesses, as opposed to foreign investors and foreign businesses. There doesn't seem to be anything in preventing a virus that allows foreigners and their property to be subject to regulation differently from domestic commercial operators and so on. And I would think that some of those discriminatory actions will be what are the focus of complaint.
Well, one contentious point here would also be the fact that this pandemic came at a time where international relations were already strained for many different reasons. And obviously there was already an ongoing push, globalization, multilateralism, etc. Have you ever had the perception that this pandemic has also been used as a pretext for some governments around the world to accelerate, if not keep pursuing a political agenda disguised as a pandemic rescue package, or we obviously not in its entirety, but with some provisions here and there that, as you say, they might not have necessarily be related to some specific scientific advice or a specific fix for the pandemic itself, but could have originated in a different context for different purposes.
There have clearly been instances where responses to things that have happened at the global level because of the virus and the pandemic appear to be motivated by macro political issues that existed prior to the pandemic. So that's absolutely seems to be the case. I would have thought, from everything I'm reading from these pandemic experts around the world, there seems to be a near unanimous view that this pandemic is an example of why there needs to be greater international cooperation, at least in the field of health and these kind of pandemic issues, rather than less cooperation. And it's interesting to look at the history of global cooperation about these major health issues. It really started in the middle of the 19th century. There were a series of treaties, international treaties, that were called the International Sanitary Conventions. It started with a conference in Paris in 1851, and by the end of the 19th century had led to a number of treaties providing for global cooperation in relation to cholera and plague and typhus and smallpox, then got added in the beginning of the 20th century and so on. The science and medicine from the mid-19th century onwards was leading to greater and greater cooperation. And the World Health Organization grew out of the UN process on the basis of these global initiatives to cooperate in terms of these macro health issues. And the experience of this pandemic seems to be that no country is an island. Even islands are not islands, metaphorically. There do seem to be instances of states using the pandemic as an excuse to further unrelated diplomatic and global political agenda. That's got to be a great concern for all the citizens of the world.
Right. And I guess that is also an element of that narrative that you mentioned at the very beginning, of countries exposing themselves to some arbitration claims.
Exactly. I've noticed in the last couple of weeks that an increasing number of countries around the world, from all different kinds of political economic context, have been declaring that they are going to increase scrutiny of foreign investment in their country.
Yes, that's a big push.
And they're saying it's because of the pandemic. I have yet to see an explanation, apart from the words pandemic, as to why greater scrutiny of foreign investment has anything to do with a virus called COVID-19, and how greater scrutiny of foreign investment would prevent pandemics in the future or anything like that. It just seems to be an example of some possibly questionable review practices that may, I don't know, it depends how these things are implemented, but may possibly violate obligations that exist in bilateral investment treaties, as we've discussed earlier.
Volterra Fieta, your law firm specializes on international arbitration. Would you expect this to become a major headache for host states? Or are we still, it could happen on paper, but we will probably see just a few cases. What's your feeling?
My feeling is that it really could go either way. And I think we'll see a number of cases arising. We won't see a number of reasonable, practical resolutions of disputes. We act almost in equal measure, 50-50, for governments and investors in these kinds of disputes. And we settle far more disputes than actually go to arbitration. And the reason for that is that most investors want to conduct business. They don't want to make money from litigation. And most governments, they want to have businesses and they want to have foreign investment and they want to have employment, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. There are some exceptions to this, and there are some states that are, conducting programized expropriation, like Venezuela right now. Very sad for the people of Venezuela. The government's driving it into the ground. But usually, expropriations and violations of obligations under investment treaties are accidental. They're not targeted at a whole industry. And there is usually scope for a reasonable, settled outcome with a bit of compromise on both sides. So we settle more of these disputes, both for investors and for states, than we do actually arbitrate them. But sometimes, for political reasons, a government cannot or will not settle. Or a claim is actually very unreasonable, and an investor might be trying to blame the government for its bad business decision. So I could see arising out of this pandemic a number of legitimate claims brought by foreign investors against governments that have used the pandemic as an excuse to expropriate foreigners or give a slight boost to domestic economic actors or things like that. And I could also see a number of claims being brought where governments will quite easily be able to point to legitimate public health measures implemented as a matter of necessity, which even if they weren't perfect, were not violating international law obligations. So I could see it go both ways.
I mean, now we are analyzing the situation with a benefit of hindsight in a way, and we are coming out of a lockdown. But if we go back to where we were in February in Europe, for example, the level of confusion at both a civil society level, but also at the policy making level was widespread, meaning that nobody would have ever expected any sort of lockdown measure was introduced that the government would actually do that. And that it's independently from the fact that you were in Italy, that was the first country that got hit in Europe or in Spain, but also in the UK that has always lagged a couple of weeks behind Spain and Italy, for example. Still, the civil society didn't believe that we would get to a point where we would have to deal with a lockdown, and also the government felt confused in that very early phases of the pandemic, and they didn't have compliance with bilateral investment treaty at the very top of their priorities in that particular moment. Is it realistic now to argue that there is a case for investors to sue host states in these particular circumstances?
My answer would be that it would depend on the particular fact situation of each circumstance. And I'm not trying to avoid the question, but I think that's a genuine answer. For the average foreign investor whose investment has caught up in some general public health regulations that were, even if mistaken, were genuinely based on existing science and advice and didn't target a particular industry or didn't target a foreign investors or particular foreign investors from a certain country or something like that, then it would be hard to argue that was more than just some bad luck and that the state was allowed legitimately to regulate in the face of a public emergency of potentially catastrophic enormity. If there's been some surreptitious targeting, if there has been discriminatory treatment, if there's been action that was sustained for a long period of time that wasn't based on science, et cetera, then arguably there will be legitimate claims. I would have thought that the most sensible thing for investors and governments at this stage, you know, where there's been 4 or 5 months of these sort of measures in place, is to see what happens in the winding down and as things become slowly less locked and so on. Obviously, the global economy is significantly hurt. Growth rates have been reduced or eliminated. In fact, there's been shrinking economies in a number of countries, including the UK. I would have thought the most sensible thing would be to try to negotiate any disputes and resolve them through negotiation. And I would say that both to governments and to investors. Try and unwind the problems that may have arisen unintentionally as governments, you know, rushed to do certain things, if the actions were legitimate and well-intentioned and so on.
Okay, Mr. Rotero, I would say a very last question. I understand, and I read a few articles published by you and your colleagues at Volterra Fieta, going back to the issue of the need for stronger global governance on health issues and a more coordinated regional, if not global, response to things like a global pandemic like COVID-19. You are proposing to new mechanisms, including a UN convention on pandemic suppression. So do you want to elaborate a bit further and give me a feeling of what do you mean with that and how that would improve the global governance of a pandemic like COVID-19?
I should start by saying the idea of having a specific treaty dealing with pandemics like this would not in and of itself be a magic wand that would solve all the problems of the world or even the problem of the next pandemic or this one. But the idea really is to address the shortcomings of the World Health Organization and the international health regulations that are in existence. And this is in no way to criticize the WHO or the health regulations, but merely recognizing that neither the WHO nor the international health regulations were intended to provide a binding set of rules that guide the cooperation and require the coordination of countries to confront a pandemic. The current regulations are not enforceable. Many of the provisions are not mandatory. They're so broadly phrased that they allow states to judge themselves. And of course, they don't find themselves guilty. There's no way to ensure compliance. And the WHO is not an institution that can or should issue sanctions for violation of rules. So everything is voluntary. Now that's right. On the one hand, when you have international cooperation that is voluntary, then presumably it's enthusiastic and in good faith and so on. But at the same time, you get the problems that we've seen in this pandemic when there is not effective coordination of a minimum level. So it seems to me, as a non-scientist, non-doctor, that effective international mechanisms are needed to ensure global cooperation at a minimal level. Things like early detection and reporting, sharing of information and technology, supporting developing countries' health capabilities, rapid creation and dissemination of vaccines, protection of intellectual property for vaccines, and payment for the development of vaccines, and these kinds of things. The problem with trying to put this all onto the WHO is that that's not what it's meant to be. It's meant to be a doctor, a world doctor, not a world police. First of all. And second of all, there are a number of important countries, powerful, large, wealthy countries that take issue over how the WHO has operated. So to try and get some new cooperation revolving around an institution that is not sort of universally endorsed is in itself going to be problematic. So why try to beat your head against the door to do something that might have a better chance, just like those original global pandemic treaties of the late 19th century and early 20th century just have a one-off focused treaty that requires basic levels of cooperation and information sharing and transparency and allows states to call other states out and say, hey, you need to do this, and has clear guidelines and obligations and abilities to compel and to seek enforcement. So that's what I would want to see in a world global pandemic treaty. Mm-hmm. Of course, any treaty is only as good as the text of the agreement that's reached. So there would be no point in having a global pandemic treaty that just copied the international health regulations and didn't add anything.
This has been obviously a big wake-up call for the whole global community. It would be definitely be interesting to see whether we will find ourselves in a more cooperative world also through schemes and mechanisms as the possible new convention on pandemic suppression that you have elaborated on just now, or else we will find a more divided world where everybody kind of tries to look after their own countries and cooperation becomes as a second priority. I guess that this is the bigger elephant in the room. It's a big question mark at the moment, and it's going to be interesting to see where we will be in 5 years from now.
If we think back to the great plagues of Europe in the medieval times, I think particularly the one in the 14th century that wiped out half or two-thirds of the European population. You know, the idea that you can isolate yourself and not be affected, you know, it hasn't worked in the past, hasn't worked this time, unlikely to work in the future.
Robert Volterra, thank you very much for this very fascinating, insightful discussion.
Thank you very much for the invitation to participate in the program, and I've enjoyed our conversation very much.
Do you want to give our listeners a few details on where they can find you, where they can find your law firm?
As you pointed out at the beginning, I am a partner at the firm of Volterra Fieta, and that's a law firm based in London, England, United Kingdom. My email address is robert.volterra, V-O-L-T-E-R-R-A, at Volterra, V-O-L-T-E-R-R-A, Fieta, F-I-E-T-T-A.com. And that's how I can be reached. And we've got some client alerts, and we've held some seminars on these sorts of issues, and people can find them on our website.
Okay, that's fantastic. Thanks again, Mr. Volterra. Thanks, everybody, for tuning in. You can find all our podcasts on typical podcast platform, Acast, iTunes, and also on our website, fdiintelligence.com/podcast. Until the next time.
Hey, The latest episode of the Next 5 podcast is all about health prevention and vaccines. I speak to Kate Hashey at GSK.
For every dollar invested in improving health, there's an economic return of $2 to $4.
Murray Aitken at IQVIA Institute for Human Data Science.
The benefits of adult vaccination are compelling.
And David Sinclair at the International Longevity Centre.
Preventable conditions amongst those aged 50 to 64 in the UK cost $27 billion a year.
Listen to the full episode of the Next 5 wherever you get your podcasts.